Welcome to Monday's programme. How are you doing? It's Monday the 21st of June 2021. Tis myself, the BBG. I've got a very special guest for you a little bit later on in the programme. Can't wait to meet her. Do drop me a tweet, BBG Richie. Let's chat then.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, I had a nice weekend myself. I hope you had as well. Monday's programme, I've given you the Twitter thing. If you do send me a contact through the website, I will see that as well. If you'd like to contact me through richieallen.co.uk, go ahead and do that. I've got a really terrific guest for you a little bit later on. Gemma Cooper is a hugely accomplished journalist and broadcaster. Has done it all, really, working at the BBC, working in regional newspapers, then working for the BBC for many years, weather presenting, radio presenting, television. Brilliant, really. It's been a bit of a difficult year for Gemma. She left the BBC after she had been well seen at an anti-lockdown march earlier this year. Okay, that made the national press. The newspapers, as I suppose is customary, were very unkind and very unfair to Gemma in their reporting. And she had to deal with the fact that somebody or somebodies working with her, people she thought were her friends, went and sold a story about her to the national press. Now, I can tell you from talking to Gemma a couple of times, she's not interested in BBC bashing. It's not about that. We're going to talk about her and her own journey, not just this year, but before that. Like I said, I've had the pleasure of speaking with her. Obviously a very intelligent lady. She'll be with me around about the top of the hour and we'll chat. I was due to be speaking to somebody else at this hour, but that's not going to happen today. It might be tomorrow or Wednesday, and it's to do with vaccine injury, but just leave that with me. Hopefully we can do it tomorrow or Wednesday. I've a lot to talk about anyway. There's much for me and you to get into in the course of the next hour. So let's do that. And as I said, please don't be a stranger. Drop me a message through the usual channels or avenues even. Avenues Baldy, that's the one. Cool today. That's Murphy's Law in action. Where are the scientists? Where are the academics? You have a new aircon unit installed in your state of the art studio and, well, the weather takes a turn for the worse. Sod's Law, Murphy's Law, call it what you want. It's cool and, well, a bit softer today. Soft day, begorra. So last week when Boris Johnson announced, flanked by Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, when he announced that Freedom Day would be delayed, Andrew Lloyd Webber, the man behind Cats, yes, don't hold it against him, as a musical genius who owns six theatres, darling, well, he manned up, his testicle swelled, and he said, I'm opening up anyway, be Jesus. I'm losing millions. I'm opening up on the 21st. They can arrest me if they like. Freedom, said Andrew Lloyd Webber. So are Andrew's theatres open in the West End tonight? No.
Surprise, surprise. The unexpected hits you between the eyes. The unpredictable.
That's the surprise, you see.
Surprise, surprise.
That's right, Cilla. That's right. Tough guy, eh? Keyboard warrior, eh? He'd have to fall into a cement mixer to be a hard man. Yes, what a wimp. Andrew Lloyd Webber reneged on his threat to open and be damned. Yes. Apparently, he said, he didn't want his staff and members of the public being arrested and fined. Give over, Andrew. You are telling little pork pies. 4.5 minutes past the hour. By the way, if you detect a slight alteration to my vocals, It's because on Friday, my voice disappeared. Saturday, I couldn't speak. Yesterday, I just about got through the Sunday morning melodies. So here I am. I'm getting better. All right, all right. Now, yesterday's Sunday Times, very serious story. Headline, 4,000 women report period problems after COVID jab. Subheading is, subheadline, vaccine watchdog says the evidence so far does not suggest any increased risk. The story reads, the vaccines watchdog is closely monitoring reports from 4,000 women who suffered period problems after having their COVID jab. Britons having the vaccine are warned that they might get a sore arm, feel tired, achy or sick, or develop a headache. But period irregularities are not mentioned on the list of potential side effects. Now, official data obtained by the Sunday Times shows that the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, or the MHRA, it received 2,734 reports of period problems linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine, 1,158 related to the Pfizer jab, and 66 linked to the Moderna vaccine up to May 17th. The issue, which typically involves heavier than usual bleeding, could have affected many more women who would not have thought to report their experience. The majority of issues were reported in women aged between 30 and 49. Asked why the problems had not been added to the official list of possible side effects of the vaccines, the MHRA said a review with experts had found that there was no need to do so. The current evidence did not suggest an increased risk of period problems after the jab, it said, but it had published information on reports of menstrual disorders in its weekly report on adverse reactions. Now, the Sunday Times, dear listener, quotes a reproductive immunologist from Imperial College. Her name is Victoria Mayle, and she said more women were likely to have been affected than the number of case reports. It's definitely true that not everyone will be reporting any menstrual changes they have noticed to yellow card, she said. Now, the yellow card is the MHRA scheme for people to report suspected side effects. And Victoria Mayle said, it's definitely true that not everyone will be reporting to Yellow Card simply because not everyone knows that it exists and that they can file a report. Now, you know from listening to this programme, some of my guests in recent weeks and months have expressed incredulity that the public isn't more often told about the yellow card reporting system. If you're rolling out brand new medicines, never before seen, brand new technology, doesn't it stand to reason that you would want to know about any adverse events? Therefore, you would be more likely to constantly remind the public to get in touch. Well, that isn't the case, strangely. So, we'll keep an eye on it. Big story in the Sunday Times. And presumably the BBC, Sky, GB News, Channel 4, Talk Radio and LBC, they all covered it today, didn't they?
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse.
Nothing to see here. Please. Nothing to see here. God, no. The Beeb, Sky, Channel 4, LBC, Talk Radio, not remotely interested. And there were loads of opportunities today to ask various government representatives and opposition representatives about the story. Not at all. Not a sausage. Not a bit of it. Move along. Up to 10,000 Japanese fans will be allowed in to the stadium for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics and the other venues, despite warnings from health bosses. Only Japanese now. Overseas fans are banned, but organisers said domestic fans could attend if they didn't exceed 50% of a venue's capacity. The Olympics are scheduled to begin on the 23rd of July, the Paralympics a month later from the 24th of August, rules for the spectators. There are rules if you're a Japanese person and you're going to one of the venues. Here's Enda Brady from Sky.
Infection rates are rising in Japan and a lot of concern amongst the Japanese public. So the 10,000 people maximum who will be allowed into stadia over the course of the games, which get underway in just over 5 weeks' time, they will all be Japanese citizens. Overseas spectators have already been banned. So these will be very, very different games. You know, previously we've seen people winning medals and representing their country, family and friends in the crowd and the great atmosphere. It's going to be very, very different in Tokyo. And a lot of rules as well for those people who do choose to go to the venues. They will have to wear a face mask at all times. There can be no shouting or speaking in a loud voice, and they must return home immediately. And we've already heard, of course, last week from the Japanese Prime Minister, Yoshihide Suga, who is encouraging people not to go to the venues, but rather stay at home and watch the games on TV.
Yes. Oh. Yeah, you can go to one of the venues, so long as you wear a mask while you're there, and there's to be no shouting or speaking loudly while there. And everybody else should just stay indoors and watch it. How does that work? How do they expect people to go and watch the world's greatest athletes breaking records and just stand there and be like, yeah, that was brilliant, wasn't it? Well done. Hey, how are you? Oh, yeah, that was great. Yeah, wow, world record. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mad. Mad. They're saying the same. They're telling people attending weddings here in the UK, outdoor weddings, to do the same thing. No dancing. No singing loudly. It's 11 and a half minutes past five. Boris Johnson said it's looking good for the 19th of July to be the terminus point for England's coronavirus restrictions, but he didn't rule out the prospect of further lockdowns in the winter. It's likely, by the way, the government will announce that the double jabbed will not have to quarantine when they get back from their holidays, nor will the double jabbed need to isolate if they happen to meet someone who is infected with the Rona. Anyway, Johnson, it looks good for July 19th, he says, but can't rule out lockdowns over the winter.
As I say, the vaccination rollout is going gangbusters and loads of people are coming forward now for their second jabs. Please come forward, get your second jab. And it's great that today we'll have done all of JCVI 1-9. So everybody over 50 will have been offered two jabs as of today, plus all care workers, all the vulnerable groups, huge numbers of people. I think almost 60% of adults in this country have now had or been offered two jabs. So we're one of the most vaccinated countries in the world. But look at the numbers of Delta, the Delta variant. It is sadly going up still. It's going up by about 30% a week in cases. Hospitalizations up by roughly the same amount. And so sadly, ICU admissions into intensive care. So we've got to be cautious, but we'll be following the data the whole time.
And just finally on that, you've been very clear, you want the unlocking in July to be irreversible. Your science advisors, and we'll talk about them a bit more in a minute, I hope, are saying there is always the possibility this winter we are going to see resurge, we might need to lock down again. Will you rule out the potential for future lockdowns, potentially as early as this winter, because of changes in the pandemic?
Nothing to do with him. It is totally beyond the control of Boris Johnson. Surely the BBC guy knows that.
It's in the pandemic.
I think you can never exclude that there will be some new disease, some new horror that we simply haven't budgeted for or accounted for. But looking at
new disease, new horror,
at where we are, looking at the efficacy of the vaccines against all variants that we can currently see, so Alpha, Delta, the lot of them, Kappa, I think it's looking good for July the 19th to be that terminus point. I think what the scientists are saying is that, you know, things like flu will come back this winter. We may have a rough winter for all sorts of reasons. And obviously there are big pressures on the NHS. All the more reason to reduce the number of COVID cases now, give the NHS the breathing space it needs to get on with dealing with all those other pressures. And we're certainly going to be putting in the investment to make sure that they can.
some new disease, some new horror in the winter, said Johnson. Indeed. Going nowhere. Hey, by the way, by delaying 4 weeks until July 19th, it was meant to be today, June 21st, just by delaying until July 19th, that four-week period, what has that done to jobs and the economy? Let's ask BBC business reporter Nina Warhurst, speaking from Liverpool.
It's estimated that 73% of bars, so nearly three quarters, haven't been able to open at all because of restrictions around social distancing, for example. And the cost of extending for hospitality, simply for that four-week window, well, that's estimated revenue is down by £3 billion collectively. And the estimate is that that puts another 300,000 jobs at risk because of that reduction of revenue into hospitality venues. And there's loads of museums around here. It's a fascinating part of the world, seeped with history. But all of these places are seeing reduced capacity. People can't, for example, go in and touch and sense things properly. So they're down to a third of normal capacity, museums and attractions. It's absolutely huge. And so it's not just the museums themselves. It's things like the gift shops and cafes.
Gift shops, cafes, billions, she said, in 4 weeks, billions in lost revenue, nightclubs, clubs, the restaurants, the reduced capacity, the museums, and the jobs. But nobody cares. Nobody cares. Hey, this is Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford. Shall we have a tune? Let's have a tune. It is a Monday. I've lots more to tell you before. Gemma Cooper. You can't wait. I hope you can't wait to meet Gemma. Will join me around about the top of the hour. Looking forward to that. Here is ELO and Jeff Lynne and Live and Sing on your Richie Allen Show, which is with you Monday to Thursday between 5 and 7. If you're new to it, welcome aboard. Good to be with you, as always. BBG Richie on Twitter then. And I'll read out some of your tweets when I come back from this. Live and Sing, ELO, on The Richie Allen Show, 20 minutes past 5. A number of you eagle-eared enthusiasts of The Richie Allen Show, you did notice Boris Johnson talking about the flu coming back. Oh, the flu, we had a lot of fun with that, didn't we, last year and early this year. The convenient disappearance of the flu. Yes, I'm not going to play you all the clips. I've still got them of various Irish scientists and UK scientists saying, fortunately, we've had no flu this season. None. Why? Why is that? Well, because we locked down. Yes, not getting into it. I'm not going down that road because we'd be here for a while. And we might get all giggly and silly. We don't need to do that. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, the GIMP. Yes, he has all the credibility of the GIMP in Zed's dungeon. Just look at him. Just look at him. He was on BBC Breakfast this morning. Embarrassed, are you, that the Prime Minister and Cummings, Dominic Cummings, were mocking you on WhatsApp and calling you hopeless? Well, here is a guy called Dan Walker posing the question to Hancock.
Surely it's embarrassing, isn't it, for your boss, the Prime Minister, to say that about you in whatever context?
No, it isn't, really.
It isn't, because when you're as thick as Hancock, it's a regular occurrence. So you become immune to it. You become impervious to the insult.
Because of all the things we've delivered together. And, you know, we're here talking about the success of the vaccine programme, right? That was something that I very much led from the department, working with the Prime Minister. He's been a massive supporter of it throughout. And of course we've had obstacles and we've had people that we've had to deal with on the way, but what I can tell you is that the delivery of that program has been absolutely fantastic. And if you look across,
we've had people we've had to deal with along the way. He's as subtle as a sledgehammer, is Matthew Hancock. RichieAllen.co.uk, you might want to leave me a message there. You can tweet me. Tim says, Richie, I heard today that some schools have shut off their water supply for pupils. Really? Not allowed to even get a drink from the water taps, says Tim. The fascists are tightening the screws day by day. came by this from someone talking on Rachel Elnaugh's fortnightly Zoom meeting today. That's very anecdotal, Tim. We need to see a bit more evidence that schools are switching off their water supply and refusing water for pupils. I'll believe it when I see it. But thanks, man. We'll have a look out for that. And Mike says, Richie, so Johnson says the flu will return this year. Did it take a year out? Greetings from North Down. I'm listening intently at the gym, says Mike. Thank you, Mike. Listen to me at the gym. Good man. Get stuck into that treadmill there. Alan says, why does Hancock always sound like he's just about to cry or crap himself? I don't know. I'm sure there are many, many reasons for that. Hi to Paul. Hi to Tim, who's in sunny Brazil. Richie, we're back into curfew tonight at 9 o'clock until 5 a.m. No alcohol sales at the weekends. No parties, even at home. 10 days to flatten a curve. But nobody knows which curve. Alcoholics dying of liver failure? Asks Tim. In Brazil there, Tim. And Rob Hanley tweets me to say, Richie, my 7-year-old lasted an hour in school today before we got the text about a positive case. They've sent the entire year home for 10 days. And some arsehole has obviously tested their 7-year-old. I despair. What about Billy Gilmore? Chelsea player. Played for Scotland. He was terrific in England and Scotland's draw over the weekend, I think. Sunday, was it Sunday? Or was it Saturday? Sunday. I can't remember. Saturday. He was brilliant with young Billy. Now, there's nothing wrong with Billy. He's in rude health. He's absolutely tickety-boo. But they're testing all these players every single day of the week. And the PCR tests are unreliable. So poor Billy Gilmore was told this morning, you failed a COVID test. And Billy's like, but I'm fine. I'm hunky-dory. Just give me a can of Iron Brew. I'll be okay. But no, he's going to miss Scotland's vital crunch clash with Croatia tomorrow night. It's madness. It's utter madness. Let's move on. It's 25 minutes past five. Drive time. So we heard from Hancock. Remember that idiot pretending to cry on Good Morning Britain? Remember when that poor old lady was jabbed? Anyway, Hancock even also said that there would be information in the coming days on the booster plans.
Fabulous.
It's all good.
Thanks, Kay. Booster plans. There will be boosters in the autumn. Details will be forthcoming in the coming days. Okay. So Talk Radio spoke to the CEO of NHS Providers, a man called Chris Hobson. Chris Hobson told Talk Radio, Julia Hartley Brewer, they'll be boosting us with COVID jabs forever and ever and ever. Amen.
We're in a bit of a sprint phase at the moment, as you know, because we're very keen to kind of ensure that on July the 19th, we can remove those social restrictions. So I think it has been an achievement. But what we're really keen to do is carry on with that achievement. And what we now need to do is really start looking forward, get ahead of the virus, get ahead of the problems that it causes. And for us, that basically means ensuring that we can, as I suspect we will need to for probably, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years, basically ensure that we can vaccinate the population year in, year out against COVID-19.
Yeah. I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. We could be here in 40 years' time fighting COVID, says NHS provider CEO Chris Hobson. Jab, jab, jab. It'll just go on forever and ever and ever. The BBC virologist, he's not the BBC's virologist, but he's a virologist who appears on the BBC non-stop, Chris Smith. He agrees. Here he is on BBC Breakfast.
Well, what we anticipate is that we probably will need to boost people's immunity, because as far as we can tell, immunity to coronaviruses as a group of viruses is not long-lived.
Boost we.
In other words, in some people it might be, but in the majority of people you probably become susceptible again. With that in mind, we probably need some kind of annual top-up. And given that we already have a process for doing this for the flu, it makes sense to use the learning and all of the experience we have going back decades for how we do surveillance and make vaccines and update vaccines and get them into the most vulnerable groups for flu And we do the same thing for coronavirus. Mm-hmm. Because broadly, the people who are most at risk from flu are most at risk from coronavirus infection. So it makes sense to use all that learning and to do this. And we do have some idea as to who's probably going to be prioritised mm-hmm. for those sorts of booster jabs. Probably the people who are at the top of the JCVI list.
That and same probably, list we saw that's the right, jabs first time
and
around.
Probably the people who were vaccinated first.
Yeah, let's kill off all the oldies.
Who were at the top of that list, because the most time will have elapsed by autumn by the time we want to give those boosters. So probably we're looking at an autumn rollout.
We.
Probably prioritising those people who are at the top of the list the first time to start with.
Outside of the independent media, there isn't a journalist alive. Outside of the independent media. And in the independent media, you can count the journalists on one hand, two maybe. Who is we? We need to do this. We need to get boosters into people. We. Who is we? You're basically a television talking head. Who do you mean by we there? But, you know, you would die. It's like patience waiting on a monument. Patience on a monument. I can't remember. Junior Soprano. Yeah. Before one of these presenters will ask the question. It's coming up for 29 minutes past five. Shall we get off coronavirus for a moment? Let me remind you, in around 30 minutes or just over 30 minutes, Gemma Cooper will be with me. Gemma had some terrible press earlier this year. A hugely accomplished broadcaster and journalist was at an anti-lockdown rally. And because of that, ended up leaving the BBC. The newspapers were dreadful. They really were. If you Google Gemma's name, you'll see. Maybe she wouldn't want me telling you to do that. But terrible stuff. And some of her colleagues even, well, spoke to those newspapers and sold stories about her. So we'll talk to Gemma. As I said earlier, she isn't remotely interested in bashing the BBC. She's not interested in revenge or any of that old nonsense. She just wants a good old chin wag. And I like a good old chin wag. So we'll have a good old blooming chin wag is what we'll have. Hey, let's get off COVID just for a minute and talk athletics. Yes, let's talk athletics. Now, let me read you my story. This is my take on it. New Zealand's Laurel the Trunchbull Hubbard has become the first ever transgender athlete picked to compete at an Olympics in a controversial decision. Officials have selected him for the women's weightlifting team for Tokyo 2020 after qualifying requirements were recently modified. The Trunchbull had competed in men's events before coming out as transgender in 2013. Critics say Hubbard has an unfair advantage, but others have argued for more inclusion at the Games. Inclusion. I am grateful and humbled by the kindness and support that has been given to me by so many New Zealanders, the Trunchbull said in a statement issued by the New Zealand Olympic Committee today. He will compete in the women's 87 kilo weightlifting category. Hey Tom, you hear this? A great big fat bloke calling himself Laurel is now on the New Zealand women's weightlifting team. You hear that?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Yes, it's as simple as that. Just say that you're a woman. Grow your hair a bit. Do the old name change thing, deed poll. And, well, you can compete with the ladies. You can compete with ladies. Anyway, Nicola Williams, who works for Fair Play for Women, Nicola is not happy and spoke to the BBC. Nicola is a real woman, by the way. Nicola.
We have to think, you know, why do we even have female sport, female weightlifting in the first place? You know, it's because male bodies are different to female bodies. Someone who's born male has benefited from lifelong testosterone and female people haven't. So, you know, when we ask, should Laurel Hubbard compete in women's weightlifting? Well, the answer is no, because Laurel Hubbard was born male and has benefited from testosterone. So it's unfair for Laurel to be taking the place of a natal-born woman who has now not made it to the Olympics.
Yes, I would agree wholeheartedly. I've just tweeted a picture of Laurel the Trunchbull Hubbard, by the way, just in case you don't know who he is. It's there, 28 minutes to 6 o'clock, just in case you need to be somewhere. Hence the time check. Right, so that's Nicola Williams. Let's get the other side of it. So for balance, the BBC brought on a trans man. a woman who transitioned to male, a female who transitioned to male, and got on a men's collegiate swim team. Somebody called Skylar Baylor. Now, Skylar is trans and thinks damn right the Trunchbull should be on the New Zealand women's weightlifting team. Absolutely. But what about testosterone and that the Trunchbull went through puberty before calling himself Laurel? He's got an advantage, right, Skylar Baylor?
I think there's differences in all bodies. And I think that there's we know that there's plenty of differences within cis women's bodies as well. And I think it's really, really important to me that trans children, trans kids are able to compete in sports.
Okay, but then address that question about unfairness, because we've also heard that from the former New Zealand weightlifter, Tracy Lambrex. Now, Tracy Lambrex was forced to drop a division to make the 2018 Commonwealth Games because Laurel Hubbard was actually selected in her preferred event. She also saying it's unfair. She said everyone has just shut up and they are worried about how they will be viewed in regards to talking out about transgender athletes. In other words, she's saying other competitors are scared to speak out on this issue.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the first thing we have to start with when we talk about transgender athletes in sport is that trans women are women and trans men are men. And I think that I hear oftentimes when we talk about this that people are, quote, displacing other athletes. And the reality is that when somebody wins, it doesn't matter what their gender identity or gender background is, when they win, they are absolutely displacing somebody else because that is what winning means, right? And cis women displace other cis women all the time when they win. And trans women are women, and sometimes they are also going to win.
Yes, and win by miles. 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 But the testosterone man. Puberty. Look at the size of the guy. Come on, Skylar Baylor, these things matter. The bodies, come on.
I also know that biological differences in sport are many, especially within cis women. And here's the thing, and this is where sexism...
They should get slapped across the face with a big massive fish every time they say cis women, shouldn't they?
And misogyny and also racism also come into play. If you look at a white man such as Michael Phelps, when he has a biological advantage, such as having half the levels of lactic acid that the typical athlete produces, people praise him, the Olympic Committee praises him as a superior genetic specimen. But when women have any kind of difference within their bodies, it's considered unfair. And this isn't specific to transgender women. We see this all the time. Serena Williams has been policed multiple times, and this happens often more with black women specifically. Serena Williams is not a trans woman, and she has been called a man all the time because of how her body looks and how she is good at sport. So this is not new. This is the continued policing of black and brown women's bodies in sport that is also spilling over into other marginalized groups, such as trans women.
There's a lot of controversy over Laurel Hubbard, as you know. Donald Trump Jr. has said...
Why would he bring up Donald Trump Jr.? This is typical BBC. They've got Sharon Davis, a champion, an Olympic champion, a female, a real woman, who's been speaking about this and speaking about it with authority, Sharon Davis. And yet this dipstick of a presenter brings up Donald Trump and Piers Morgan. Who cares what Donald Trump or Piers Morgan thinks about it?
Has said that it is ridiculous, this selection.
Well, he is right.
Piers Morgan has said that women's rights are being destroyed on the altar of political correctness.
Yeah, I have to be really clear with you. I don't think either of these people are experts in sports, so I don't think that their words matter in this place, except for to be blatantly transphobic and blatantly unkind.
Yeah, if you disagree with them, you must be transphobic or bigoted or racist. Look at the state of the Trunchbull. I've just tweeted the photograph. Go to, if you're not on Twitter, just put into a search engine Twitter Richie Allen Show or Twitter BBG Richie, and you'll see the state. Nobody in the world would identify that person as a female. I don't set out to be unkind. As you know, dear listener, from listening to me many years, I do not have a conservative bone in my body. I'm live and let live to my bone marrow. And people should live as they please, but this is insane. Of course it is a racing woman. A real woman. A real female weightlifter has been deprived of the chance to go to the Olympics by a man. By a big hairy man. It couldn't be any simpler. There's nothing homophobic about it. It's a fact, Jack. Right? And if I was starved of sex for 1,000 years, if I lived to be as old as Moses. Yeah, I'm not going to finish that sentence, right? Because you know where that one is going. I think it's time for another tune. Let's go way back to a film called Streets of Fire. And this song by Dan Hartman on The Richie Allen Show. Looking forward to speaking with Gemma Cooper, top of the hour. Lots more news to get through when I come back in about 3 minutes. Dan Hartman from Streets of Fire, I Can Dream About You. What a great film that was. I can never remember the name of the guy in it. Was it Tom Perret? I know that Amy Madigan was in it. The wonderful Amy Madigan, it must be said. Great actress. Love Amy Madigan. Think Uncle Buck if you are trying to think of who Amy Madigan is. She was in many more films than Uncle Buck, but she's brilliant. And I think Tom Perret. It's absolutely insane, this. I've just had a tweet from Sarah Plumley. Sarah was on the programme. She's a private maths tutor these days. She worked in education in national schools. She was on the programme. Brilliant guest was Sarah. She's in France. But we were really interested to learn, weren't we, when speaking with Sarah, that she was a very successful football referee. Not only did she referee men's Sunday League football in Greater Manchester, but she went on to be an assistant referee at the top of the women's game and even went on to officiate the women's FA Cup final. I think she was the assistant referee. So Sarah, who I can confirm is a real woman, I haven't met her now, but I know she's a real woman, she says, Richie, this makes a mockery of the final bastion of meritocracy. Sport. As someone who's faced genuine discrimination in sport, I played football and cricket in the late 80s and early 90s, back when, quote, only lesbians, unquote, competed. This is a real kick in the you-know-whats. Yes. Now, I always have tongue firmly in cheek when I refer to somebody's appearance. It's cheap, it can be cruel, and it's really lowbrow to comment on somebody's appearance. I do it sometimes because, look, I don't have any compunctions about myself. I'm no oil painting. And I get criticised for my appearance quite a lot, and I don't care. I laugh it off because I've got thick skin. But look at the Trunchbull. Look at a photograph of this person who claims to be a woman. Right? If you're a man. Now imagine having relations with this person. And you know, this Stonewall organisation, this charity, which says that it represents LGBTQ plus people, it has gone on the record as stating that if someone like me or someone like you says that you wouldn't fancy somebody like that, you therefore must be transphobic because you don't fancy somebody like Laurel Hubbard. It's beyond vaudeville. We're living in some sort of lucid dream, I think, nightmare, where this stuff just ploughs on with very little opposition to it, apart from the far-right media and programmes like this. You know, I mean, the goal of the BBC, to quote Donald Trump Jr., when you've got hundreds of female athletes really concerned about this, I mean, you've got this Laurel Hubbard's opponents in Tokyo, knowing that they're going to struggle to beat this person. I'm not referring to Laurel Hubbard as a woman. Because if Laurel Hubbard is a woman, I'm a ballet dancer. Right? I'm a racehorse if this person is a woman. I'm not having it. Let's move on. I never speak to be cruel or to hurt. But there are times when you've just got to say, enough is he bloody enough now. Okay. The former chief scientific advisor David King, he had the job that Patrick Vallance now has. David King was on Sky today. I think this guy is barking. Sarah Hewson asked him, is there any chance, David, of an early reopening, say July the 5th, instead of July the 19th? David King.
I doubt it very much, Sarah. I think what I want to say is the following. Yes, the rollout of vaccines has been amazingly successful, and we are very fortunate in that the vaccines used in this country are efficacious against the Delta variant. So all of that is the good news, and many of us are protected. But we mustn't forget, it's not 100% protection that we'll have by July the 5th. And this is such a virulent virus that it is capable of picking out those people who haven't been vaccinated. Some people are saying they don't wish to be vaccinated, and others are simply not yet vaccinated for one reason or another. And by this, I mean the virus continues to exist amongst younger children. There's no children vaccinated in this country. And so in the age group from babies up to the age of 18, this is the vulnerable group, and vulnerable not in terms of the impact on them, but the fact that the virus carries on in their bodies and gets transferred to others. Now, these children don't live alone, of course, and so they are capable of passing this on to other people. I think what is missing is a comprehensive strategy. And I would say it's been missing since day one of the whole pandemic.
Mm. There's David King advocating jabbing millions of children in this country based on a pack of lies. The notion that children who don't get the bloody thing to begin with can carry it, even though they don't display any symptoms, and they can then pass it on to older, vulnerable people. When I say, dear listener, you've been with me for years. When I am expressing an opinion, I tell you it's conjecture. It's just my opinion. When I'm stating irrefutable fact, I tell you it is an irrefutable fact that asymptomatic people do not spread disease or germs to other people in their vicinity. It's a nonsense. Might be later than July the 19th, even, he said. You get used to that prospect, right? Because it's possible. Anyway, more from David King.
So, no, I think, quite frankly, I don't see a comprehensive strategy for bringing this disease to an end. Instead, what I see is a reliance on everyone having had the disease or everyone having been vaccinated to get us out of it. And this is going to take quite a while. It'll be quite possibly beyond July 19th. I'm one of those who would love to see July the 5th as when we can behave properly and normally again. I would certainly be sad to see July 19th cancelled. But it's going to have more than the Prime Minister saying it's looking good for the 19th of July. It needs actions followed by words. And vaccination is important, but it's not the end game. What about vaccinating the 12 to 18-year-olds at high school?
Why we don't know yet from the JCVI, do we? We don't have the recommendations from the JCVI on that.
Terrible, isn't she, Sarah Hewson? Rather than say to him, isn't it abhorrent to ask children to take an unproven, unsafe potentially, medicine that they do not need for themselves, but to ask them to take it on behalf of society? Isn't that abhorrent? Rather than ask that question, she simply points out to him that, well, we don't know what the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation has recommended yet. She is wretched. They all are wretched, aren't they? All of
no, but we should be pressing for that. We've seen
we should be pressing for children to be jabbed for something that, an illness that doesn't touch them. There you are.
In other countries introducing, such as Israel, introducing vaccinations for 12 to 18-year-olds, the United States as well. Yeah. So I think we need to press for that.
Press for that. He also wants to get the masks back on the faces of the kiddies.
And we also really need to press forward for reasserting that children at school, 12 to 18-year-olds, should be wearing face masks. I can't help thinking that that the removal of face masks as a requirement for school children was brought about because people thought then we'd get herd immunity in that group much more quickly. This is a very, very dangerous way to proceed if that was the intention.
As I'm listening to you, Sir David, it sounds like you want to take far greater precautions now, and yet the vaccine...
I bet she was top of her fucking class, eh?
...vaccine rollout is continuing at pace. And there are people getting a little bit fed up and asking, well, what's the point? I've stayed at home. I've stayed away from work. I've gone forward. I've had my vaccinations. If there's no advantage to it, what is the point? In terms of advantages being looked at, could we potentially look at the stay-at-home isolation orders for somebody who comes into contact with a COVID case being relaxed if you've been double vaccinated?
Yeah, this is the idea of privileges for the double jabbed. If you're double jabbed, you don't have to quarantine upon your return from a holiday, and you wouldn't need to isolate if you were in contact with somebody who had tested positive for COVID. What does King say?
So, Sarah, I'm glad you asked that, because let me tell you, I'm against lockdown. I am in favor of separating those with the disease and those who've been in contact with them from the rest of us, so we can go about our normal daily business.
She doesn't dig down into this, either because she's wretchedly stupid, which is possible, or because she doesn't want to go there. But he's harped on and on and on about separation. I wonder if he was pressed on the point, would King concede that he is considered basically putting people who test positive for COVID, putting them in some sort of state-run facility. Now, stay with me for a minute. I'm not going all InfoWars on you. I don't do that. But I wonder, has that been considered? This guy is part of Independent Sage, by the way. Not the Sage group, which is Chris Whitty, Valance and many others. That's the scientific advisory group on emergencies. There's an independent version of that, which is more to the right and opts for or pushes for more draconian measures than Sage itself. He's harping on and on and on and on and on about separation. I wonder, have they been discussing... Well, let's get rid of this bloody thing. Let's get zero COVID. When people test positive, they've got to check into a government facility. I am not for a minute saying that anybody has said that. I'm asking. I'm wondering aloud, as I am prone to do.
We could have introduced that in February, March last year. We could have avoided a very large number of fatalities if we'd have done that. We could still have introduced it, particularly in that period at the end of August last year, when the numbers were so low. What is the point of testing everybody? And we always heard the importance of testing, if it isn't to isolate those with a disease from the rest of us. And that is the way we handle epidemics anywhere in the world. If the British scientific group go out to West Africa, as they've done recently with Ebola, the first thing we install is the business of separating those with the disease and those who've been in touch with them from the rest of the population.
Fascinating stuff, that in one sense, isn't it? Very, very sinister in another sense. It's 7 minutes, or just under 7 minutes, to the top of the hour, to 6 o'clock here in the UK. Welcome, if you've just joined, to Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Gemma Cooper will join me very shortly. Looking forward, I really am looking forward to speaking with Gemma again. You can drop a tweet to me during that conversation, BBG Richie. I'm not sure if Gemma is on Twitter. I looked for her, but I couldn't find her. If she isn't, it's, of course, wholly understandable. In fact, why would anybody want to be on Twitter? I've been threatening for years to do what I did with Facebook. I deleted my Facebook account, and I said I would do the same with Twitter. But Twitter does come in handy for two reasons. I get to read your comments during the programme, and I do get to ask people for information and invite people onto the programme. But otherwise, I don't like it very much. Let's finish with these privileges for the double jabbed, because Danny Altman was on the BBC this afternoon. Now, he is a professor of immunology at Imperial College London. And he was asked, and it's a brief answer, but it's very telling. He was asked by the presenter, what about these privileges for the double jabbed? Danny Altman, Imperial College London.
Well, for me, that's in the same category. It's I can see the pragmatism of it. I can see it's useful, certainly worth debating and discussing. Again, the devil's in the detail, because people are very variable. And when I look at data in the cohorts we look at, there are some double vaccinated people who would be very safe and wouldn't be infected or transmitting, some who really wouldn't be.
All right, Danny, thank you very much. Danny Altman there, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College.
If I had finished the interview after what Danny Altman had said during my time in commercial radio, I would have been fired.
Double vaccinated people who would be very safe.
Let's just hear that again.
And when I look at data in the cohorts we look at, there are some double vaccinated people who would be very safe and wouldn't be infected or transmitting, some who really wouldn't be.
Let's just hear that again, because it's a bit of a bombshell, and you know I don't oversell stuff.
Variable. And when I look at data in the cohorts we look at, there are some double vaccinated people who would be very safe and...
Some double vaccinated people who would be very safe.
And wouldn't be infected or...
Wouldn't be infected, wouldn't transmit.
Transmitting. Some who really wouldn't be.
Some who really wouldn't be.
All right, Danny, thank you very much, Danny Altman.
Thanks, Danny. All the best, pal. Look after yourself, says the presenter. Instead of saying, what do you mean, Danny? Can you give me any idea of the numbers? Can I see this data? So how many of them just simply would not be protected and would continue to transmit even though they have been double jabbed? Do tell, Danny, because it sounds like this is a bit of a bombshell there. But no, he waves him off. Thanks for coming on. Arrivederci. All the best. We'll see you soon. Look after yourself there, El Mucker. Thanks for coming on the BBC. It's exactly 4 minutes to 6 o'clock, the Richie Allen Radio Show. With me, the BBG, live from Salford. Richie Allen Show Towers. This is a number one for Whitney Houston. In a few minutes' time, Gemma Cooper will be with me. You don't want to miss Gemma. Ooh, yeah. Uh-huh. Right, music from Whitney Houston. I Want to Dance with Somebody. It's exactly 6 o'clock then. That's a UK time, of course. Now, do drop me a tweet, please, if you'd like to do that. You can contact me through the website richieallen.co.uk. I do see the messages during the programme. Now, my guest for the rest of the programme is a vastly experienced and very accomplished broadcaster, journalist, presenter. A career with the BBC for over 20 years, but before that worked in regional newspapers, a proper journalist. Now, you will have known her, of course, if you're a licence fee payer, if you watch the BBC. But a lot of people got to know her earlier this year because she received a lot of negative press attention after she left the broadcaster. And she left the broadcaster after she'd been pictured attending anti-lockdown protests. Very difficult time for her, I would imagine. A professional woman, brilliant broadcaster, as I said. And to find out that one of your colleagues, maybe more than one of your colleagues, had gone to the national newspapers and sold a story to them, that can't have been easy either. But I'll tell you what I was impressed by, really impressed by, was that when we spoke a few weeks ago, she was adamant with me that she had no interest in getting any revenge on anybody or on any organisation at all, that if she did come on to have a chat with me, it would be to chat about her overall journey, because it goes back way even before what happened this year, back many years. Look, you know her as Gemma Cooper. I'm delighted to welcome her to Monday's Richie Allen Show. Gemma, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Richie. Thank you so much. I mean, from the BBC to the BBG in the space of 6 months, who would have thought it?
What a fall. What a fall. As far as spectacular falls go, it doesn't get any worse than that. But no, thanks, Gemma, for coming on. I think you're terrific. And I suppose the best thing to do is, well, we're going to have a chat and I'm not going to be, I don't want to ask any questions. I'd like you to kind of talk about the events of the last few months from your own point of view as to how you experienced them. So I suppose you could go back to where it all started, when you went to the anti-lockdown gathering. Why did you do that?
Well, I mean, it's twofold, really. I had what I would describe as a kind of conscious awakening back in 2010, 2011, and I started experiencing life in a very different way. I was doing a lot of yoga and meditation, and things started happening to me, and I... Through that conscious awakening, as anyone who's had a conscious awakening knows, if you haven't, it's very difficult. It's difficult to explain a conscious awakening to someone. But I had one through yoga and meditation, and I started living my life in a very different way. And gradually, through coincidences and synchronicities, I started mixing with different groups of people, getting involved in the alternative conference scene. This was all in my spare private time. But through that, I started to hear about this. You know, I was going to lectures and conferences and hearing people talk about Agenda 21 and mandatory vaccinations. And I was going to the alternative scene really because I was interested in the nature of reality and consciousness, because I'd had a big conscious awakening. But I was going to also hearing about other things and geopolitics and things like that. And I thought, oh, I don't know about that. That sounds a bit far-fetched to me. I think some of these people need to get out more. And then when everything happened and we are where we are now, it twigged in my head. I thought, hang on, I've got books in my bookshelf that have talked about this. I've got DVDs in my collection. And God, this is it. This is massive. This is huge. And so there was a personal reason for wanting to go and hear different voices to the narrative. But also professionally, when I saw the mainstream approach to this narrative, which is there is only one side to this story, I thought, that's not right. I've never experienced a situation like that, where the one narrative, and that's that, no debate, this is reality, and you can't question it. So there was a personal and a professional reason for wanting to hear different voices. One, to hear if what I thought was coming true was coming true, and also to think, why aren't these voices being represented within the mainstream? You know, it's a very credible doctors at some of the rallies, very credible health professionals talking about how to look after your immune system. They just weren't getting heard. So that's my reasoning for going.
Every fibre of your being as a real journalist wants to hear these people. Why are these other doctors saying these things? Let's ask them. Maybe they're full of bull, but let's find out anyway. And I suppose that's you as a natural journalist. And you, like me some years ago, are wondering, why are these people not being heard alongside the Chris Whittys and the likes of Patrick Vallance? And you're finding that difficult to come to terms with.
Well, yeah. I mean, a BBC newsroom, you know, is always a place for robust debate with lots of different opinions on the story of the day, whether it's the American elections, the general elections in this country, Brexit. There are different voices. Whether you agree with them or not is a moot point. It's a difference of opinion, a rounded debate. And what I saw very quickly was no real debate. The only debate was around the official version of everything, which is there's a deadly virus and we're all going to die. That's the starting point from which the argument was coming from. And there was little fringe debates around that. But it was, the narrative couldn't be questioned. And if you wanted a different opinion, you had to go to a rally, or you had to go and find it.
Would you have, Gemma, out of interest, would you have been, you know, you have your downtime like anybody else, you might be in the canteen. Would you have said to any of your fellow presenters and the producers and editors who worked with you, would you have said to them at any time, you know, Jesus, I wonder why we're not speaking to some of these people? Was that a conversation that anybody was having around you?
No, it wasn't. And I remember talking to one colleague about the validity of the PCR test, and they had no idea what I was talking about, and they'd never heard of Kerry Mullis, and this person's quite an expert in health. And they said, oh, that's quite interesting, what you're saying about the PCR test not being, you know, fit for purpose, effectively. But didn't want to have a debate, didn't want to talk about it, you know, then change the subject to something else. And I was chatting with another colleague, and I'm not BBC bashing. This is just conversations I had in the newsroom with people that also made me think, hang on, there's really something not right here. But I remember we had an outbreak of cases in a food factory, I think in Swindon. And of course, the BBC juggernaut swung into action, like, get to Swindon, you know, that's our job, BBC's job, you know, to report. But it was like, get to Swindon, stand outside the factory, cases, cases, cases. And I think I said to my colleague as he was about to leave, I think we should be careful here, you know, cases doesn't mean deaths, it just means cases. You know, and a lot of people might have no symptoms. So I think we're frightening people here. Well, he looked at me, he went red, and he was like, no, it's really important, Coops. You know, we've got to report this. And I thought, so I think we're scaring people. And the reaction I was getting from people was that I was somehow nuts for saying those things. But it's just like, hang on, should we just take a breath? Should we just slow down with this?
And context. But,
yes. Other people were just not seeing it like I was seeing it, and it was difficult.
Yeah, it's incredible you're bringing up the PCR test. I mean, I do remember, Gemma, very early on, or maybe midway through last year, I do remember Julia Hartley Brewer doing her job and squeezing a government minister on the false positives around the PCR test. And I had a fleeting moment of hope, Gemma, that something might come out of that. But then, I have no idea now, this is only speculation. Maybe Julia was asked not to go back to that in future programmes. I don't know. We've got Gemma Cooper on the programme, vastly experienced broadcaster, BBC journalist, who parted company with the broadcaster earlier this year. We're chatting about that, but much more besides as well. And I mean it, Gemma, you know, I'm not prone to be kissing the backside of my guests. I'm not. I think you've got a lot of class, because nothing in the conversations, nothing from what I've seen, and we know some mutual people, you've got no interest in bashing people. You want to talk about what's going on and how, you know, that impacted on your own career. I think you've got a lot of class, you know, not looking to be sticking the knife into the BBC or anybody else. It's really good that. So you went to, again, we spoke about this off air, you going to see what was going on at Bristol or in London is a natural journalistic thing to do. Why wouldn't you want to do it? Let's find out what these people are saying and let's meet the audience. Are the audience a bunch of tinfoil hat-wearing nutters? Or are they just people who want answers? So you go down there like a journalist. And when did you get the hook, as it were, to ask you, hey, Gemma, what are you doing?
You mean from the BBC?
From the BBC, yeah.
Yeah, well, I went to a rally in Birmingham last August. And then I went to a rally in Cardiff in October. And I, you know, I'm not on any social media. I absolutely despise it for lots of different reasons. And I kept it completely quiet. I did not tell anyone at work what I was doing. I think I told hardly anyone in my personal life what I was doing. But of course, everything is filmed. And inevitably, the BBC found out about it and said, you know, we need to investigate this because members of staff are not supposed to go on protests. And quite rightly, in a way, my BBC managers got wind of it and they were like, listen, we need to really get to the bottom of why you went on these things. You know, you went on protest and it's not allowed. And I said, well, yeah, I understand that. I understand that. But several members of my newsroom had gone to Black Lives Matter, which was a huge protest, much far, far bigger than the little rallies I was attending. And that either was completely overlooked or wasn't known about. And I thought, well, other people have gone to other protests and I'm being hauled over the coals by my managers for going to an anti-lockdown. And I said about Black Lives Matter, and everyone's free to do exactly what they want. I mean, we represent the licence fee payer, and lots of licence fee payers have opinions on all sorts of things, and as do BBC staff. But I remember saying to my managers, hang on a minute, you know, several members of the newsroom went to Black Lives Matter, and one of my managers actually did say to me, that's different. That's anti-racist. You went to anti-lockdown. And that was the point where I thought, whoa, hang on a minute. One rule for one and one rule for another. Who's deciding what is where the line is drawn and who can do what? And it was at that point I thought to myself, you know what? I think my time at the BBC, I think I need to, for my own kind of sanity and rest of my life, I think probably I've had enough.
It's laudable on the one hand that the supervisors would say to experienced presenters like you, laudable to say, listen, you can't be seen now to be showing any favour or any bias towards any cause or another. But on the other hand, I think, respectfully, I think they're wrong. I would expect I never had any authority. I was always a producer or a presenter. I had to answer to, you know, editors and heads of news and stuff like that. But if I was a head of news, I would want my journalists to be out and about, you know, finding out what's going on, taking the pulse of the people. I mean, Gemma, it's not as if you were standing there screaming, what do we want? End the lockdowns. When do we want it now? You weren't doing that. You weren't carrying a placard either. I think you had a very good case for saying, well, I'm a journalist. I'm curious. It's my natural, it's my default position. Did you make that argument? Did you think of it at the time?
Yeah, I did. I said about hearing different voices outside the narrative, and you know, but I'm not gonna. They were doing their jobs, you know. Yeah. I did breach guidelines, but for me, the benefit almost outweighed the risk at that point, because I wanted to hear what other people were saying, and I had also, like I say, as a result of a very profound consciousness awakening back in 2010-11, I'd also been thinking this. I've been hearing about this. This has been foretold, if you like. This has been, and I was quite frightened. I thought, if this is going where some people have been saying for years it is going, we could be in serious trouble, you know. So for me, it was, I want, personally and professionally, I thought, I knew there was a risk, and I knew that obviously it would be on my head. And but I thought, you know what, I still want to go. And you could argue that's foolhardy of me or reckless of me, but as lots of people are saying, you know, one of the great quotes of last year, this year, is these are unprecedented times.
Yeah.
Listen. And that was it for me. I wanted to sort of hear more from the other side.
And I'd like to get into the conscious awakening, because that's very important. And we'll steer to that, with your permission, in a few minutes. We'll finish up with, I suppose, the hard news, which is what happened. Very disappointing. And again, when we spoke privately, I've got to say this. Now, Gemma has not asked me to say this. These are my observations. When we spoke privately, no bitterness, no animosity at all. I'm staggered by that. It's a humble thing, I think. I hope to learn from it, really. But somebody you work with, they did a lousy thing. They went and spoke to newspapers about you. How did you feel about that? That can't have been easy.
No, it was horrendous. I decided to hand my notice in. It was accepted. I was working my notice, and I was quite happy to go quietly. You know, I turned 50 this year. My mum died a couple of years ago. I thought, I don't know how much time I've got left on this planet, and I want to live a life that's more true to me. So I was getting ready to go quietly. I was quite happy to just leave my career. You know, it's everything I'd ever worked for. I was willing to walk away from it. And that career meant a lot to me. And I've never got married or had children. I put a lot of energy into it. So I was leaving. And at that point, whoever decided to do what they did, for whatever reasons, it was almost like, no, we're not going to let her go quietly. We're gonna go to the papers. We're going to make her out to be a crazy person. And you know, a few other things have gone on as well. And we're just going to put it all out there, try and, what I could see, destroy her so she won't work again. And, you know, I really hate her. We really hate her. And she can't just leave. We're going to have to go to the press. You know, the thing the BBC always says, it wasn't, you know, it's not the tabloid press. It's got values and standards. And I was gobsmacked. You know, I had the newspapers knocking on my door before Christmas, and lots of horrible stuff printed about me. And, you know, I haven't even read the articles in their entirety because I didn't want to give it my energy. I mean, I've had the bullet points off friends and family.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of stuff in there. I mean, obviously, it's true. I went to rallies, and it's true. I did, you know, appear at those things, but there's a lot of stuff in there, and apparently I made somebody cry. Well, that's news to me. And I made people feel unsafe, but no one ever came up to me at work to have a chat about it, you know, and say, what are you doing? And I would have had a chat, and I would have had a debate, and said, well, this is why I'm doing it, and let's have a conversation. And that never happened, unfortunately. So yeah, seeing myself splashed across the papers and my reputation roundly trounced and a huge public hanging, it was a difficult time, Richie. It was a terrible end to last year. It was a terrible Christmas. And I was shocked, I think. Shocked, really shocked. And I don't blame that person for doing it. It's such a polarizing issue, this, you know, and it really has triggered people, and it really has made people think. I'm sure that person that did it thought they were in the right, you know, that I'm an evil person and I shouldn't have been going to these things. In some way, they thought they were doing probably a moral duty, or they were right, but it was hugely upsetting. And I was good at my job, and I thought I was popular, and I thought I had friends there. I'd been to plenty of weddings and birthdays, but it was awful. But in a way, I owe that person a pint, because they firmly shut the door on a mainstream life that I was becoming increasingly disillusioned with way before any of this, and a lifestyle I'd long outgrown, I think. And I'd sort of fallen out of love with mainstream media a while ago. I was even questioning whether I wanted to be a journalist anymore. So if I'd gone sort of like quietly and without fanfare, and it was my decision, then I always would have second-guessed myself and thought, what have you done, Gem? You know, you've walked away from that career, that life. And I would have always thought, maybe I've made a mistake. You know, maybe I've got this wrong. But because of what happened, and I ended up being in the papers from my own colleagues at the BBC who I'd known for years, it's like that door is so firmly shut. The windows are boarded up. The drawbridge is up, and the moat is full of water. You know, there's no going back. So I don't second guess my decision, because it's been made very clear to me that chapter of my life is over. So, you know, that person really, in a way, they helped me do what my heart had been sort of telling me increasingly loudly over the years to do, and my head didn't have the guts to do it. So in a way, I owe them a pint.
I love that.
Anyway, you know, and that closure means I'm now free to create a different life or do different things. And I'd wanted to do that for quite a while, especially after my mum died.
Wonderfully philosophical and lovely thing to say that you'd buy the person a pint and
move on.
Yeah. Oh, no, I believe you. I absolutely believe you. I try to learn, you know, when I do this program from people. Listen, you mentioned a few minutes ago, I was. It's not that you were. You are a good journalist. You are a journalist. You'll always be a journalist. And if I don't say this later on, I better say it now. You'll be a gift to the independent media. You will be, you know, with your experience, your talent. My great friend Jean Ann Crowley, famous actress, wrote for all the broadsheets, great writer. You know, I say to Jean Ann, it's going to happen. You know, we're going to get terrific journalists coming out for one reason or another. And what a gift they'll be to the, I hate to say information war. I don't like to use terminology like war, but to the battle to get information to people, because you're so credible, you see. And forget about the papers. Now, you might say it's easy for me to say that. I never had to endure that. About 3 years ago, I had a bad time of it. For a couple of months, they gave me some stick. But, you know, nothing like the rubbish that you had to put up with. But, you know, you came out the other side of that. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. Gemma Cooper is our guest. BBC, well, Gemma's done it all, really. At the BBC, regional newspapers, a great journalist. It's had a difficult 12 months of it, but it's out of it now. I'll tell you what I'm really fascinated by, and this is you going back 10 years to the conscious awakening. What was the catalyst? What was the life event or observation or feeling? What happened to you at that time, Gemma, that made you think, wow, there's something more to everything, really?
Well, it's a funny one. I was going through a tricky time in my personal life, and I just wanted to feel better, and I wanted to be able to sleep at night. And, you know, I was such a mainstream person, but I started doing a lot of yoga and meditation, hot yoga and meditation, as a way of sort of like getting myself back on track after a tricky couple of years. And about 18 months into an intensive yoga practice, I had, quote unquote, some very strange experiences. I started having very odd experiences in bed at night. I don't take that the wrong way, but I did things like what I now know is astral projection and lucid dreaming. And I started hearing things and sort of seeing things. I started having precognitive experiences. And especially in bed at night, I would sort of hear my name being called. I know it sounds totally crazy, but it happened. And I got worried. I was like, what is going on here, you know? And I talked to my yoga teacher about it, and she went really quiet. And she said, Gemma, people pay thousands of pounds and go and live in ashrams in the mountains in India and Nepal to get what you're getting. And I said, what do you mean what I'm getting? She said, this is a gift of yoga that doesn't happen to everybody. When it happens, it's real. She said, they're called siddhas. They're called internal powers. You're waking up your inner consciousness. You're going to find yourself becoming a little bit more psychic. You're going to be more in tune with yourself and other people. And I was like, I've never heard of anything like that. I didn't go to a yoga studio to get those experiences. I went because I had a bad back and I wanted to sleep at night. Anyway, she said, don't be frightened of this. Trust the process, keep coming to your practice and let things unfold, and don't be frightened because you'll get in the way of it. And I thought, wow. And then I went off and read a bit about what she was talking about. I thought, God, that is me. I am having these experiences. I am becoming different. I am feeling more in tune with my real self. I think that's probably the best way to put it. Living more in my heart and less in my ego. And things started to change for me quite rapidly after that point. Like with everyone who has a conscious awakening or a spiritual awakening, whatever you want to call it, your social life changes, your hobbies and interests change. You are less interested in consumerism and materialism. You're just operating from a different plane. And what became very common after that and happened quite quickly was, like with other people on the conscious path, is that I started through synchronicities and coincidences, started getting books and DVDs just coming into my reality. And then from that, I started watching different TV channels. Like, there used to be a brilliant channel called Conscious TV. It's gone now. And loads of speakers were on that. And then a guy that was on that, he did a workshop in Glastonbury. I live fairly near Glastonbury, so I went and did a workshop. Then I met other people. Then I got involved in the alternative conference scene. Somebody said, oh, I think you'd enjoy the Glastonbury Symposium, which is a big, long-running event, brilliant event. And when I went to that for the first time, that blew my head off. It blew my head off. And I started hearing about things like geopolitics and all sorts of different things, along with speakers talking about consciousness and the nature of reality, which was the reason.
Do you mean, you don't mean exopolitics, do you? Is that what you meant to say? No.
Well, I call it geopolitics. I mean, yeah, like the political state of, that's not really my field. So if I've got that wrong,
right, yeah, I'm with you. No, bang on. No, you're right. No, because I know you know plenty about politics. No, because exopolitics is something that sometimes discussed at these conferences, which I'm really interested in and into as well. Now, can you, if I said to you, give us the, no better woman now to ask this than a BBC presenter, no better woman. If I said to you, give me a definition of astral projection or lucid dreaming that somebody could understand, somebody like me. Now, I've had people talk about that on this program before, so I have a little bit of an inkling. How would you describe it to somebody who never came across those two terms before?
Well, it's I can describe how it happened to me and how I woke up in my bedroom, and then I was at the window, and then I looked back in my bedroom, which was dark, and I thought, who's that in my bed? And then I thought, that's me in the bed. What? Whoa. And I thought, am I dreaming? What? But I was I was physically in the bed, but I was also at the window.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? And I was quite frightened. I was like, am I dreaming? But I knew I wasn't dreaming. I was like, and then I kind of thought, I'm just going to open the window. I don't know why I thought that, this version of me that was at the window. And I opened the window and I kind of flew out of the window. And then suddenly I'm flying over my little hometown. And I was really, and then I woke up. And I was like, whoa, what was that?
Now, when this was going on, Gemma, it did, because I think sometimes we know when we're in a dream, but you, this wasn't really a dream. Like, your physical body was in bed, but your consciousness was outside that window, and it felt like you were awake, did it? Like, proper awake.
Yeah, it did. But very light and very, I was flying, but not like a typical flying dream. It was different. It felt different. And I had heard of like astral projection and projection and lucid dreaming. When I was at university, I heard someone talk about it. And because I was completely closed to all that kind of thing, I thought, my God, that person's absolutely insane. What are they talking about? Are they on drugs? You know? But then these things started happening to me, and I realized there is so much more to reality than we're taught, and so much more to reality than we're experiencing. And there is a sixth sense, and mine was becoming very strong. And that was when my whole life really changed. And it changed because my experiences were changing. So when you've had something directly happen to you, you can't argue with that. You know, I didn't read about it in a book and then start believing in it. It happened to me.
It happened to you.
It's a bit like childbirth, isn't it?
And of course, the obvious question then is, did it feel right to you? Like, if you look before the astral projection, lucid dreaming, to the Gemma that you were, and then afterwards, after these things began happening, did you feel more, I don't know, this is going to sound really silly now, more complete as a person, more that this was natural, that you were in a better place?
Oh, God, absolutely. I look back on the version of myself, and she still pops up from time to time, you know, I'm not a saint, but I look back at the version of myself I was pre-2010, 2011, and, you know, I was like, in my ego constantly, and I was very interested in being seen, and I did lots of work for my local community, for charity and organising community events, which were great, but I did it as well because I liked doing it. I liked being, ooh, Gemma Cooper, look at what she does, isn't she great? And I was so in my ego with everything in my life. And I felt that side of myself begin to dissolve.
Right.
It's a gradual sloughing off of your egoic self and a more emergence of a, what felt like my true self.
So how did that, this is brilliant, so how did that impact on you going to work day to day?
I think I became a lot nicer. I became a nicer
colleague. Yeah, because that's the obvious question, isn't it? How did it impact on you as a professional woman? Yeah, you became nicer, you became more relaxed.
Yeah, I'm much more relaxed, much easier to work. I didn't take things as personally. Had I realised, of course, that a conscious awakening affects every area of your life, because you start to shift vibrationally. So, of course, your friendships change, your hobbies change, your interests, all of that. But it was only a matter of time, really, after that it would vibrationally affect my relationship with my chosen career. Because at some point, although the career was the last thing to go for me, and I was trying to hold on to it tooth and nail, really, my ego was very shocked when everything happened last year.
Yeah.
But vibrationally, it was only a matter of time before that drip, 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 drip it was going to affect every area of my life, including that relationship with the BBC and my relationship with mainstream media. I found myself every day going through the papers, as all journalists do, just looking at it like they were comics, you know, like, oh, headline after headline, and the stars falling in, you know. And I changed. The media didn't change. I changed. And my perception of the media and what it was, the mainstream media, I just thought, oh, do you know what, I think I might be done with this. And then when the juggernaut of fear rolled into action and this one narrative storyline, I thought, oh, God, I don't know. I'm in a sticky wicket here because I'm seeing it differently and I'm experiencing it differently, and I don't know if I can survive being in this environment. And of course I couldn't, so that's probably a motivating factor to going to these
rallies.
I was about to say, one of the motivating factors possibly for my subconscious, which was trying to get my attention, is my brother said to me, trouble is, Jem, you're a bit like a person who is in an unhappy marriage and wants a divorce but didn't have the guts to say it, so has an affair. And that's kind of where you were, you know. You knew the risks and you knew, but you did it anyway. You know, was that my heart trying to push me out, I wonder?
That's a great analogy. I must mention here now, not to be dropping any names or anything, but where astral projection is concerned, some of us will have read The Men Who Stare at Goats by John Ronson, which is largely about General Burt's Doublebine and the covert, I suppose, research that he was doing for the US military. And he's no longer with us, Burt's Doublebine. He died, but about 3 or 4 years ago, he came on this programme because his wife, who's a general practitioner, Rima, persuaded him to come on, General Burt. And he was lovely, very senior at the time. And he was half deaf, God love him, but totally compos mentis. And Burt talked very lucidly about the money that the Pentagon spent on these programmes. Not only the US military, but other militaries around the world. This is real stuff, this. I wouldn't dare now butter you up, Gemma. I totally believe that your experiences were real. So the question is then, did you learn to enhance that ability, you know, the astral projection? Did you get better at it in terms of what you could do with it and where you could go?
No, not at all. It only happened a couple of times. It was almost like it made its presence felt and to show me that there is more to life than meets the eye. And I still get experiences at night, and I think this is quite common. As you're dropping off to sleep and you're in that wonderful brainwave state between awakening and asleep, I get a vibration in my head and I can feel a vibration, and it sounds like lots of drills are going off in my head. And that I know. And I know it sounds a bit crazy if you're not into this world, but it is your astral body getting ready to leave the physical body and go off onto the astral plane at night and have its little adventures. And that it can be frightening, that vibration, because you think, oh, here we go. And then you just go to sleep and then you have crazy dreams and wake up in the morning and think, oh. But I didn't really go down that road with it. It's almost like it served its purpose.
Right.
And then from that became a whole new way of life. New friends, new interests, being on the conference scene and really having a great time, you know. I was like, yay, wow, spiritual awakening, brilliant. But now, had I known what it would lead to? And then when the virus narrative broke, I was like, oh, spiritual awakening also means look at this. People have been talking about this and predicting this, and I've been going to lectures on it thinking, oh, I'm not sure, sounds a bit far-fetched, but it's happening. So then, and I always wondered why I had a conscious awakening, because my whole life changed. Now I realise it's because of this.
It's because of this.
This is coming, and there's a big split in consciousness between people who see it more like us and people who are still very much in fear. So I was pushed onto, I'm not going to use the word side, but I was pushed onto a way of perceiving this, which a lot of other people are around the world. There is some kind of global awakening, and I'm glad I'm not on the other side and living in fear, which is a horrible place to be.
And we'll come back in a moment. Look how quick time flies. Look, it's 27 minutes already to 7 o'clock. Gemma Cooper is our guest, a former BBC presenter, more than 20 years, regional newspapers, great writer, broadcaster, radio, weather, presenting as well. All came to an end, of course, this year. We've discussed all that. Lovely having Gemma on the programme. Before we come back to what you think might be going on and where we might be, and it would also be nice to talk a little bit more about, you know, those who don't see it and those who do, because there is that split that you described. I have this thing where I'm beginning to believe that I think we might be born with this might sound stupid now, we might be born much closer to the information in terms of we might even know about it. But everything that happens to us when we're in our formative years seems to be kind of aimed at disengaging us from that information. I don't know if there's any truth in that, but I'm beginning to think that, you know, education, not just education, but the things we're exposed to on television, radio and stuff, kind of almost like disassociates the child, takes the child away from that closeness to understanding who they really are. Am I talking crap? I might just be talking crap. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, if you're talking crap, I agree with you 100%. So we're both talking crap. I mean, some people would argue that I've been talking crap for years, especially people that know me. But no, I agree totally. And I think that the way we are told to live our lives from a very young age and the way we are taught to experience the world, which is compete, be better. That is the classic living in your ego, you know, and the way of life we're prescribed once you hit the school system. I didn't see it at the time. I was a fully bought up and paid member of this system. But the way to be a valid human is always think, how will this make me look and what will people think of me? And that's what the school system encourages you to do. You know, who's got the gold star? Who's got the silver star? Does it really matter? They're kids, you know, leave them alone. But no, we are trained to live in a certain paradigm and also a very narrow paradigm of within that of achieving and achieving, status and status, materialism. And also it's go to school, education, get a good job, get married, have kids, get a house, get a bigger house, get a bigger car, go on holiday, go on a better holiday, retire, have a few good years at the end if you're lucky after all that stress and striving, and then die. Totally. That's the paradigm, you know? And Once I stepped out of that, I realised how much I was in it and how unhappy it had made me. Once I was living my life from a more conscious place, I was like, wow, what a waste of time the last 38 years were. You know, if only I'd known this way of life was possible. It's much nicer. It's much more authentic. And I feel better and I'm a nicer person. And that, again, you can't discount your own experience. But I do agree with you. There is some sort of, call it brainwashing if you want, but you get about 4 good years at the start. When you're a little kid, you know, you're running around. Yay, everything's brilliant. Oh, yeah. Oh, I've fallen over. Doesn't matter. Someone will pick me up. Oh, I've pooped my nappy. Doesn't matter. Someone will clean it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're a holistic person. There's no good or bad. You're just fully in the moment. So you get 4 good years and then you're in the school system. You know, they knock it out of you. No joy. No, you know, sit down, shut up. Give your authority away to a teacher. Give your power away to an authority figure. Whereas instead of trusting your own instincts. So you get 4 good years before all that happens. And at the end, you get maybe 10 to 15 good years if you're lucky, and you spend a lot of time trying to become like a child again and have fun and do things, and the bit in the between is a massive waste of time, you know. So I do agree with you.
That goes along. Well, I mean, I think you're very humble anyway. I think you are, as a, you know, from the get-go. But I suppose that explains as well, you know, your lack of animosity to those that essentially betrayed you and did you wrong. You were done a great wrong by, in my opinion, this is not, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think your employer did you a great wrong, and I think your pals left you down badly. It goes a long way to explaining your humility and your decency. Where are we going, Gemma? I always say this, and I feel like a bit of a broken record. I can't believe that we're talking about exchanging privileges in return for agreeing to be injected with something that you don't want. So I'm not going to put any words in your mouth. We don't even have to talk about whether the vaccines are any good or not, whether they're harmful or not. We don't even have to talk about that. I don't want one because I don't believe I need one. I will never have one. And yet I face the reality. I'm not alone, that I might be told in the very near future, well, there are things you can't do then, Baldy. That's just, if you know, even me being around some of the people I've been around for the last few years and reading some of the same books you did, I can't believe we're here, Gemma. I sound naive, I should know, because again, we've seen some of the same stuff, but I just can't believe we're here. If we don't do something about it, this is not going to be an inhabitable place for people like you and me in the near future, is it?
No, but it's the question of what you do about it. I mean, you know, I have no animosity to what that person did. But look what happened to me when I went to some rallies. You know, I hadn't broken the law. I hadn't done anything awful. I hadn't committed fraud or punched someone or anything like that. I went to some rallies. So by doing that, I was publicly hung, you know, on the court of public opinion and hated probably by most of my colleagues. So, yeah, you need courage at the moment. And it's really difficult. If that can happen to me or other people for going to rallies, what will happen if we say no to an experimental injection?
Yeah.
How will it go? And also, like, I was extremely lucky, you know, Richie, we discussed this actually in our little pre-chat a few days ago, but don't get me wrong, you know, although I'm not bitter and I think it was meant to happen, I think it's part, leaving the BBC in such a way was part of my journey, if you want to call it that. But if I hadn't had the spiritual tools in my workshop that I'd gained from the last 10 years of my conscious awakening, I did have some very dark thoughts around Christmas time. I thought, even though I kind of know I'm in the right by doing what I did, my career is over, my reputation is over. I lost friends, you know, and some of them really did turn against me in my private life. But I was lucky I had the tools to cope. And I was lucky that I was able to stay focused. And I'm a strong character. All my mates will tell you that, and my family, I'm a strong character. But it nearly got me. I was having some really dark thoughts and some terrible nightmares about work and the BBC and, you know, but I have got through it. And where we're going with this, I think what happened to me was hard, but I've come through it. But I don't think that's the end for any of us that continue to say there's just something not right about any of this.
But you're the answer, Gemma. I'll tell you this. We spoke about this briefly the other day. I've been around the media, different positions, commercial, little bit of national, but not very much, mostly commercial. And I've taught radio production for City and Guilds. I've done a bit of that as well. I've been around the media for years. I know that, we talked about this the other day, I know that a lot of staff at, whether it's LBC, don't get me started, whether it's the BBC, a lot of them know in their bones that something is very wrong. They know. And they have children. And they have parents and they have grandparents. They know you are the answer. They're going to have to, more of them are going to have to take a chance and they're going to have to come forward because they have got you and they have more of a chance of turning the heads of the perplexed. My great friend Jean Ann has a term for people who haven't seen it yet. She calls them the perplexed because on some level they do know something, but they're perplexed. We need more people to have the courage and say, right, well, if it means I leave my job and if I lose my friends and that lovely status, because it's nice, I would imagine, to be a respected BBC presenter. That's nice. There's nothing wrong with that. But you've got to say, well, this is not going to be good for my children. And they must know that they're not going to be left to enjoy life while everybody else is corralled into this open-air prison they're building. They must know this, some of them. It's time for them to take a leaf out of your book and be curious, at the very least, be curious. Go to a rally. Speak to a doctor. I mean, Gemma, it's a disgrace that I've had to talk to Martin Kulldorff and Sucharit Bhakdi. It's all very well having a big audience in the independent media. But the BBC and ITV should have spoken to those people. So you are the answer, Gemma. That's what I think. You are the answer. And more of them have got to do it and say, right, if we can't say what we want to say here, let's go and say it somewhere else. And I see you being the answer. I mean, I look forward to whatever you do next with your abilities, whether it's video, whether it's podcasting. It's going to be terrific. You've got all the skill in the world. I mean, we talk about production values. But more of them are going to have to do it, I think, you know?
Well, I don't want to tell anyone what to do. You know, I didn't go to be an example. I didn't want to be an example. Tried to keep it quiet. I went for myself and my heart and my consciousness and the fact that I'd been hearing about this for quite a few years and thought, I don't think that's likely to happen. Suddenly it's happening. So something was driving me. But I'm not going to say to anyone, if you're still in the mainstream media and you know something's not right, you should do what I did. Because, you know, it was hell. Look, when it all happened and I had papers knocking on my door and I live alone, you know, I've come through the other side now, but it was really, really hard. And like I say, I was equipped inside. My resilience meant I have come out the other side. But I wouldn't want anyone to put their children's education in danger. I wouldn't want anyone to put their mortgage payments in danger. I mean, it's not for me to tell anyone. It's for people's own consciousness to say, enough's enough. For me, enough was enough. And it had nothing to do with anybody else. And it was frightening and it was scary. But I'm not going to say to people they should be doing it, because, you know, if I read those articles about someone, I would think, blimey, they've been through the ringer, and it would put me off. So everyone's consciousness must dictate to themselves what they feel they should and shouldn't do with this. And
that's a good distinction. By the way, that's a good distinction to make, and well done for making the distinction. You would never do it. And I should also say that I would never tell somebody to do something that might harm them either. I should have phrased it a bit better. If somebody looks at what happened to you, because make no mistake about it, you were being made an example to other people not to do this, not to be curious, not to, you know, to go to these rallies. What I would say to somebody, if you are, if only if, and again, I wouldn't be like, you wouldn't be telling them what to do, but if you think, if you're, you know, upset or worried about what happened to Gemma because you think, Jesus, she didn't do anything wrong, really, look what happened, or, you know, I would say, like, think about where this is going and think about what you might be able to do. Yeah, I should have phrased it a bit better. Well said. Nobody should be telling anybody what to do or put themselves in harm's way or in financial difficulties. I agree with you. But, you know, I hope that in the future more people in the big organisations will think, well, this isn't right and we need to speak out a bit more or do something else. And that's, I'd like to see that. That's the point I was trying to make. I made it very clumsily, of course, but yeah, that's where I am.
Well, it's interesting, actually, when it all kicked off and when I was at the height of my, oh my God, what have I done? I've ruined my life and all of that and losing friends and my reputation trashed and all of it. I've lost my train of thought there. What did you just say? You were saying about not telling people what to do.
Yeah, but hoping that, you know, more of them, they must understand it. And by understanding it, they must feel like this is very wrong. And I would hope that feeling that way, that they might do something, even if it's just get somebody onto a program or, you know, say something in a forum or something like that. But agreeing with you that, you know, I shouldn't be telling people how they should live their life.
I remember,
you know,
what I was going to say, actually, is that for the last 6 months, because this all kicked off October, November, December last year. So it's been 6 months now, just over 6 months. And I've come out the other side. But for me, that was it. I thought, you know what? If I never type another article, if I never stand in front of a camera again, good. I'm done. I don't want that life. I'm done with it. I'm going to go live in a cabin in the woods, which everyone's talking about. Let's all go off grid, which everyone's talking about. And I was like, no, I'm done. I don't care if I have to work in a coffee shop, even though they probably wouldn't employ me either. I'm done. Media and me are done. But then the seeds of green shoots are now coming back. And I think, no, why should I run away? I've got considerable experience and talent. And I learned a lot in my career. I enjoyed my career. I enjoyed it. I was good at my job and not the best, but certainly not the worst, you know. And I have a lot to bring to the table. And I don't want to be a lone operator in any way. And this isn't about my ego either. Definitely not this time. But collaboration with people within the alternative media, I think we've all got skills to be utilized now from whatever walk of life. If you're seeing it like we're seeing it, doesn't matter what you do for a living, but it's the skills that you can bring to building some kind of new paradigm where we maybe have to live alongside people who are terrified, so terrified they're terrified of living. Fine, you get on with that. You go and live there and we'll live here and we'll try and rub along together. But why should I waste all those years of hard work and all the late shifts I ever worked and all the weekends and all the bank holidays and all the boxing days? Why should I not utilize that experience now for the good? Not for my ego, not so it can be Jim Cooper and all that. No, that's gone. It has to be, what can I do now? What can I do to help? How can I play my part in building something new and looking this thing in the eye and going, no, I'm not going to run away. Although I felt like it quite a lot. No, we've got skills and things. I've got skills I feel I should bring to the table, and I'm hopeful I can work with other people in some way and we can collaborate, because the time for the lone wolf is over. We need to stick together now.
Absolutely. And back to the production values thing. I was part of ultimately failed because it was very difficult. A TV experiment back in 2013. And it was very difficult because we didn't have much of the equipment we needed. But it was very important to us that, you know, to compete with the legacy media for viewers and for readers, we need to up our game in the independent media. And we need to, those production values need to shine. It's hugely important that And I know no better woman than you. Again, you'll be very aware of that. So I'm delighted that those seeds, those shoots are starting to sprout there, Gemma. I'll be fascinated now to see what you do.
Well, I mean, just in terms of this week alone, you know, it's the solstice today, which is a very powerful day. And I wasn't joking at the start. From the BBC to the BBG, you know, on the 21st of June. And also, I'll be doing an interview with Gareth Icke at Iconic later this week. And if someone had said to me 6 months ago, you'll be talking to Richie Allen and you'll be talking to Gareth Icke, I'd be like, no way, man. No way. They're players. I'm just little Gemma Cooper living in the West Country. I'm not anywhere near their calibre. And yet, you want to talk to me, Gareth wants to talk to me, and I think, well, brilliant, but I find it sort of like overwhelming myself to think, I'm on the Richie Allen show, whoa. You know,
you're incredibly humble. Listen, you've done national television for 20 years.
Well, regional television, actually.
Regional, but you've done national, you've done it all. Listen, I never scaled those heights, good God. Listen, that's why I said, and I meant it. Thank God, you know, that you're looking at doing things. You can't beat it, experience, talent, you really can't. Because, you know, Joe and Josephine, soap, God love them, intelligent people, but they haven't seen it yet. They're far more likely to pay attention to you than they are our old friend Alex in Texas, God love him, even though he's monstrous in terms of his reach. But they just won't watch that. But they'll watch you, Gemma.
Well, you say that. I'm not convinced, actually. I think that what they'll think is that I went a bit mad. You know, she may have worked for the BBC, but look what happened to her. She clearly went insane. She's left. Her credibility's gone with her. So I don't think, because if you can't see it, you can't see it. So they won't suddenly think, oh, because I worked for the BBC and I'm saying this, it must be true, or that I'm talking about something, and they think, oh, she's got a point there. I think that a lot of people, because of that perception shift, they're still seeing it through that lens of, you know, deadly virus, we're all going to die.
Let me shoot you down. I'm going to shoot you right down, Gemma Cooper. You're not going to, I'm going to shoot you right down. I went from an average live audience in, say, early 2020, of in the region of 65,000 to 70,000 listeners every hour, which is great for a guy out of an independent studio. Lovely, right? Great. It's over 200,000 now. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you, I'm not bragging. I swear to God and Sonny Jesus, I am not bragging. I'll tell you why that happened. I get emails maybe once or twice a week, I'm not going to lie, and they are from people who said that they stumbled across the programme. And they thought it was, so the first thing to do is they praise the production values. They say, oh, I thought, Richie, this was, they might say Radio 5 Live, they might say something else. And then I heard a bit of it, and I stuck with it. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And that's true, I'd never make anything up. And you will find that because of your ability to produce, to interview, to put together a programme, that it will happen. People who, you know, on the fence, or not even on the fence, maybe completely in thrall to the agenda, they will hear or see you, they will stumble across it and go, is that right? Because of the way it's presented. Trust me, I'm telling you. I've been banging on about this for years. I get podcasters all the time, Richie, what do I need to do? And I joke with them, I say, well, look, your microphone is garbage. What are you doing? Do this, do that. What you'll bring will be something completely different. With your experience, I'm telling you, believe me.
Well, let's see if that wonderful prediction comes true. I mean, like I say, I was so ready to just walk away from it all, and I was exhausted, and I thought, I don't care, you know, it's done. I've had a career, it was a good career, I've got nothing to prove. If it's done, it's done. I'll just go and live quietly somewhere, and hopefully not too many people will recognise me, and I'll just be free to live my life.
Yeah, yeah. But,
you know, I do feel that there is room for my experience somewhere. I know whether it's helping people or like you say, maybe my previous life will have a resonance with some people. I don't know. I like everyone in this, Richie. I'm flying blind.
Flying blind,
we're trying to create a new paradigm. Sorry, that was my dog sneezing then. I don't know if you heard it, but we're trying to create a new paradigm, but we're kind of making it up as we go along in a way, aren't we? Like, it's all new to all of us.
But you're going to love it, though. What you're going to love is being able to do whatever the hell you like. It's it's fantastic. When I left, I came up here in 2013, late 2013, and this is the gospel truth. A major commercial radio station offered me the breakfast show. And I was going to take it because I didn't have a pot to piss in. And David Icke said, Richie, if you take it, you'll kill yourself on air, speaking about the X Factor and doing the weather and talking about sport. Chuck it all in and do your own thing. And I did, and I was terrified, and I hated myself for turning down the decent job. Within 6 weeks of interviewing whoever I wanted, Gemma, and saying whatever I wanted, and I can be very childish and silly and churlish, but that was a joy, and it'll be a joy for you, I have no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah, I'm kind of feeling that now, actually, and somebody said to me, when at the height of the trauma and the height of the press exposure and the height of my, you know, I lost a stone, and I'm not particularly heavy person, you know, I didn't look great at the end of last year, but someone said to me, you'll blossom once you leave, Jen. You'll blossom because you'll have a weight lifted off you and you won't be in the BBC bubble anymore and you'll start to see life differently. And I thought, God, no, right now I'm borderline, don't know if I can carry on. And that's how it felt in a way. But that is what is beginning to happen. And I do feel much more myself, more than I have done in years. You know, I really do feel like, yeah, a new life is possible. And what was the point of going through all that last year?
Yeah.
If it wasn't, you know, and when you have a conscious awakening, you do realize there's a beauty to life. There's a pattern to life. And not, although at the time it was hell, it is what has been described. And many people be familiar with this phrase, you know, life gives you your most precious gifts, brilliantly disguised as your worst nightmares. At the time, it was my worst nightmare. Loss of status, loss of job, loss of income, loss of everything I'd worked for. But the universe, I firmly believe this, the universe has a plan for all of us. And, you know, who decides what's good or bad? And, you know, the fact I'm sitting here talking to you today, and we're having this wonderful conversation, and I feel very relaxed and free about being able to do that because I can be myself finally. So there's a new me coming out of this. And I thought the new me was birthed in 2010, 2011 with my conscious awakening. It's like that was just the start. That was just a toe in the water.
Absolutely.
This now is the real test of, like, what you're going to do with that conscious awakening, Gem. You're going to use it or you're going to run away? Well, I'm going to use it.
Everything you went through, that didn't defeat you. You had a very dark time over the Christmas and you went to a dark place. You came out of it. That would never touch you again. Nothing can stop you now, really. And I'm not blowing smoke up your backside. They failed, whatever they is, to put you down over that time period. For you now, it's just onwards. It really is. We're just out of time, by the way. I've loved having you on, Gemma. I really have. Thanks for the privilege. Thanks for coming on. I really mean that. And for sharing your insights, your courage, and for your humility and your humanity when you spoke about your colleagues earlier on. That shone through you. We've got 30 seconds before I wrap up. I'll give you the final word. Need I say you're always welcome back here anytime you want. And I'm looking forward to seeing you on television with Gareth and his crew later this week. Final word, Gemma, and thanks again.
Final word from me?
Yeah.
Wow. No pressure.
I know, putting you on the spot. Yeah, 30 seconds as well. Come on,
you know,
BBC woman.
Just everyone who sees it like we see it, we've got to just keep going now. I think it's going to get difficult. It's going to be hard and people are going to find their lives shifting. But I went through what I went through and it was horrible. But it doesn't feel like that now. It feels like it was part of this. And this big split in consciousness, this awakening, call it what you will, it's really not going anywhere. Look at the size of the protest in London last year. It started with 300 people in Hyde Park, grew to 1,000, grew to 30,000. Now we've got 100,000 plus. Saturday's going to be an amazing day in London for those who want to go on these rallies, if you want to call them that. Look how much it's growing. And they're just the people that can make it. So we're not alone. We've got each other. And even when if it gets tough, there's something happening in the world, something happening in consciousness. It's bigger than our little human minds and egos can really grasp, I think. But let's just all keep going. Stay in the heart, get out of the ego and try to just, you know, keep ourselves centered. That's what I had to do. And it seems to be working out now, whereas before I was like, oh, God. But no, it's a new beginning for all of us.
Been a privilege, Gemma. Thanks for your time this evening. Really loved having you on. And bye.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. You're the first interview I've done, so thank you.
You're very welcome, Gemma. That's Gemma Cooper, former BBC presenter, 20 years with the Beeb. Did a lot before that as well. Left very difficult circumstances for her. Come out the other side of it. Brilliant story and lovely to have her on the programme. Thanks so much to Gemma. That's it for the programme. Thanks again to Gemma Cooper. Thanks to you for listening. I've been the BBG. I'll be back with you tomorrow, Tuesday at 5 o'clock. Until then, take care of yourselves and one another. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening. I'll leave it dirty indeed. Bye now. Bye.